Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, November 12th, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Sometimes, Cherry, you come across an article that's just so interesting.
Yeah.
You want to do a whole show about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was executive producer Kevin that actually brought this article to our attention. It's an investigation in the New York Times all about a device that is very commonly put on women as mm-hmm. they are giving birth in hospitals in this country. It monitors the heart rate of the fetus. And it's given, like I said, routinely mm-hmm. to women as they give birth, despite the fact, and this is amazing, that there's really no evidence that it leads to better maternal outcomes or fetal outcomes.
Interesting.
Let that sink in for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah Cliff with the New York Times did a whole investigation about this, about the consequences of the wide use of this device. And you think it's kind of a niche topic when you approach it, but as you start to unpack the topic, you realize that the use of this device speaks to a lot of structural things. I won't say flaws. I don't want to come off as biased here. Structural things in our medical system.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to dig into all this today, and we're going to ask you a couple big picture questions. What is your experience with maternal care in this country, and are there changes you'd like to see? We'd love to get some great personal anecdotes to fill out the show this hour. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, hey, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing the stories of our listeners. And what stood out to me is how many decisions are made that have nothing to do with your care.
Yeah.
Have nothing to do with
exactly.
your well-being or your care. And so we're going to talk about a lot of that.
There's going to be some mind-blowing moments this hour, I do think.
Fascinating. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Hope we hear from you. We have our trio of news stories.
Start us off, Cherry.
Yeah, we have an update on Pennsylvania's budget. The impasse may, and I stress, may be over. Legislative leaders signaled that they have reached a $50.1 billion deal. The news of the breakthrough was first reported by the Philadelphia Inquirer, which cited two sources close to the negotiations. This deal was made behind closed doors, included Governor Josh Shapiro and some top lawmakers as well. It's unclear at this point what exactly is included in this agreement, but some details have trickled out, including $665 million in new funding for public schools. In addition to spending requirements, there could also be some policy agreements between these lawmakers as well. The Inquirer reported that that overall this $50.1 billion budget will mark a 4.7% increase in spending over last year. And I don't know if anybody remembers the original budget.
All the way back in February,
governor put forward, it was a $50.5 billion and it would have seen an 8% increase in spending. So there are some differences there. The Democrat-controlled House scheduled a voting session this morning. The GOP-controlled Senate is expected to be back in session this afternoon. So all the counties that have been waiting for the state coffers to open up, they could see some relief, maybe.
Maybe. Capital M, maybe. But it does seem like we're getting closer.
Mm-hmm.
I actually didn't realize this until I read the Inquirer's reporting on the potential deal. Every other state at this point has a budget deal in place for the current fiscal year. So we are 50th out of 50, no matter how this all goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what does that speak to? I mean, that's still the big question lingering over all this. Yes, we have divided government. So that's part of it. A lot of states, you know, one party is in control of everything. And that makes passing a budget easier. But we're not the only state with a divided government. And so I do think there has to be some soul searching. We talked about this many times.
Yeah.
This is a huge budget impasse, and it was not triggered by an immediate shortfall,
mm-mm.
right? And that's often when you get impasses, right? There was enough money to go around. Yes, there were some structural problems.
But we have the rainy day fund.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a rainy day fund.
And so just the fact that we've had this still merits some reflection, but it finally does seem to be kind of winding down.
But Avi, I have to say this, and then I know we have to move on, but
They're
going to have to deal with this in just a few more months.
That's crazy.
We're going to get another budget address from the governor.
February.
And we'll be back here again. And in just a few months, I mean, Anyway.
Well, Groundhog Day was set in Pennsylvania.
That is true.
Okay, story number two. Kind of staying in the world of politics here. The recent election of Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani as New York's next mayor has inspired some strong reactions. Some folks are vowing they're going to leave Gotham because of Mamdani's progressive policies. Well, Republican Senator Dave McCormick wants those folks to move to Pennsylvania, and he even released a video to that effect earlier this week. Let's hear a clip.
Forget about the high taxes, the socialists, the losing football teams. If you're looking for a change of scenery, all you have to do is head west on I-80. The Keystone State is calling. Come on down.
Yes, west on I-80. Not sure why he didn't say head south on I-95, but we'll leave that one aside for a moment.
Yep.
There's clearly some trolling and political point scoring in this video, but behind it, I will say there's a kernel of truth, Cherry, which is that northeastern Pennsylvania and Philly have long been landing spots for folks leaving New York City. In fact, earlier this year, an analysis of Zillow data found that Philly is now the market most searched by New Yorkers who are looking at housing listings outside the city. And it recently took the top spot away from Miami. One of the main reasons why Philly appeals to New Yorkers, experts say, is affordability, a topic that Mamdani famously avoided in his campaign.
Well, I want to say this feels very political stunty to me. McCormick selling Pennsylvania. He's definitely not a Philly guy, which is why he didn't put I-95 on there.
Yeah, couldn't get an I-95 on
and,
there.
And the question is, will people trade the lights of New York for Central PA, you know, because of Mamdani?
It's a big lifestyle change, folks.
I know.
Just letting you know.
And people were trolling McCormick online because of that. As one person wrote on X, it's all BS. You think they're going to give up Broadway, the Met, Lincoln Center, Jazz, Central Park, and the financial capital of the world, the ballet and museums, for what, a cheesesteak? That's
what the person posted. Wow.
I
thought they were going to come from Central PA. I didn't realize they were going to come from Philly.
No, they came from Philly. Oh, and then another person said, Pennsylvania is closed. There isn't enough housing available for current residents, and we don't need the blue voters here. So people from both, seems like all sides.
Don't come.
Don't come. We're closed.
There is a sticker that pops up in my neighborhood all the time on trash cans and light poles that says keep New York out of Philadelphia. So I do think that's a politically unifying
and
message.
I mean, people have been complaining about the rents here, and a lot of it has been driven up by those New Yorkers coming down saying, oh, the rent is only $3,000 a month versus $5K in New York City. So
I do like the idea that you would leave New York because they elected a, you know, a left politician and a move to Philadelphia, a city that just elected for the third time the most defiantly progressive prosecutor in the entire country.
I don't think you're
going to dodge progressive politics by going from New York to Philadelphia necessarily. But hey, if you want to give it a shot, go right ahead.
We're talking about
Go ahead.
Third story for today. As we get
closer. Yeah, this is a warning if you move to Philadelphia, by the way.
As we get closer to the holidays, 'tis the season for porch pirates. And according to the U.S. Postal Service Office of Inspector General, Philadelphia residents had more than $450 million worth of packages stolen in 2024. That's about $290 worth of stolen goods per Philadelphia resident. And that adds up to anywhere from $5 to $16 billion in porch pirate booty nationwide. That's a lot of porch pirate booty.
It's a lot of booty.
Yeah. So why are these thieves getting away with this crime? Well, easy access. People don't always report it. Companies see it as a cost of doing business and just replace the goods just to keep business flowing. That's according to this article in the Philadelphia Citizen. But I will say, under federal law, package theft is only a felony if the package was delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. So UPS, FedEx, all the DHS, Amazon, none of that really counts.
That doesn't count, yeah. I mean, it's still a crime.
It's still a crime. It's not a felony.
A federal felony.
Luckily, porch piracy can be a felony in Pennsylvania, but only for repeat offenders and for packages worth more than $2,000. I mean... I know on my Ring cam, it happens in my neighborhood all the time.
Yeah, I feel like the cams don't really stop it.
They don't stop it. No.
I don't think the cams do much.
And no one wants to call 911 for that. They just hit up Amazon or whatever.
Well, that's like the crux of the problem, right? There's just not enough of an incentive to go through the process of reporting this crime to the police when you can just easily get the package replaced from the person that sent it to you.
I will say we have a Dropbox out front with a code that, but the delivery drivers don't like to use it because it slows them down because they have to get out. They can't just put it on the porch.
You
they
can't
have to
make them use it. You can't.
We've been trying to make them use it. Yeah. They use it like 70% of the time.
Really?
Yeah.
I figured people use those. I had never tried. I assume they work.
Yeah. And we have ours and it helps, but if only if they use it. So,
and they basically only use
on the lookout.
They only use it if they're just feeling generous.
If they're feeling generous and they have the time.
Yeah.
A lot of times they'll just throw it and go.
Yeah. Bonus story real quick before we get out of here. Just a couple blocks from us this afternoon at the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia. Get your hankies.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Ready. They're going to produce the last penny in American history. Can you believe that? The last penny in American history. Farewell to the penny. A penny for your thoughts, Jerry, on the last penny.
Well, I'm wearing brown today, which is something I rarely do. And I realize now I'm going to say it's in homage to
solidarity.
The penny.
Can I just say something about the penny real quick?
Yeah.
It is. It's a great color. It's a great hue.
It is.
And I respect you, penny, for having a different look than all of the other coins.
But I will say that the penny costs about 3.7 cents to produce.
Yeah.
And for one penny, you have to spend 3.7 cents to make it.
But there is a problem now. In Philadelphia, apparently, retailers are like, you have to give exact change. That's in the law.
And they
so I don't
still
know what they're
going
to do now.
I don't know. Bye,
penny. It's a penny problem.
Yeah.
Farewell, penny.
Bye. Farewell.
That's our 2 cents.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Is the most common obstetric procedure in the country also one of the worst? That's the provocative question behind a new investigation in the New York Times. It is standard for women giving birth in this country to wear a belt full of sensors that monitor a baby's heart rate.
And yet there is very little evidence that this monitoring improves outcomes. Worse still, it seems to lead to unnecessary C-sections. Today, we'll do a deep dive into how we deliver babies in this country and what it says about our medical system.
Our guest today is the author of that provocative new piece. Sarah Cliff is a health policy reporter for the New York Times. Sarah, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And we would love to hear from you, our listeners, this hour. What's your experience with maternal care in this country? Are there changes that you'd like to see? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Sarah, we wanted to start with some of the history behind this this electronic fetal monitoring device. Explain what it is and how we got to a place where clinicians rely so heavily on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fascinating backstory. You know, for centuries leading up to the 1960s or so, doctors would routinely check the fetal heart rate by essentially putting a stethoscope or some other kind of listening device to the belly and checking intermittently, you know, different heart patterns. In the 1960s, an obstetrician at Yale came up with this device where you could kind of strap it on top of the belly and constantly monitor the fetal heart rate. And doctors loved the idea. They thought it would be amazing to have this objective record of how the fetus is doing. They adopted it before much research was done, thinking, well, of course, more information is going to be better. But when studies started to come out in the 1970s and the 1980s, they showed, you know, this didn't improve outcomes. It led to more C-sections that weren't needed as doctors kind of overreacted to all this information they were getting. But by then, you know, most hospitals had adopted it, and it is a technology that we are still using today, despite, you know, a real lack of evidence that it's improving outcomes.
So what's a typical experience today for someone who's in labor, walks into the hospital? Is this device immediately put on? Does it stay on the whole time? And who is monitoring the monitor? Like, who's watching for the signals coming out of this device?
Yeah, so it is often, I can't speak to every single hospital's policy, but based on the reporting I've done, based on, having two kids myself, it is often the very beginning of labor delivery. You're settled into a bed. These two bands, sometimes one is blue, sometimes one is pink, are kind of strapped onto your belly. And then there is a monitor with a squiggly line that is showing up at your bedside. It's showing up at a nursing station. Increasingly, it's showing up at a remote monitoring facility that could be, hundreds of miles away from your hospital that more hospitals are investing in. It is being watched by nurses, doctors, midwives, if they are part of, your labor and delivery team. It's really being watched by everybody in the care team. And it is a really kind of I remember this from, my own deliveries. I had patients I talked to tell me about this, that it feels kind of like the central focal point. When you're sitting there in labor, you can see the little squiggly line moving. You're thinking about what does it mean. It really has become like a central guiding element
And what are
of,
they looking for?
yeah.
Is it just sort of a judgment call of like, this looks weird? Or are there certain benchmarks they're looking for to say, hey, we need to take action?
So there are guidelines, and there's essentially a three category system that the doctors use right now. The way a lot of doctors described it to me is that category one means everything good, zero problems here. Category three means clear problem. Often it's a slowing heart rate that is kind of the clear big problem they're worried about. The problem is about 80% of monitoring, records, they fall into category two, which is indeterminate. Could be something problem, could not be. And that's the really tricky part. One of the reasons doctors I spoke with were openly pretty frustrated with this tool is that they said, in rare cases, it can tell us everything is great. It can tell us everything is catastrophic. It's that 80% in the middle that this tool, really struggles to capture because babies' heartbeats, they just vary really wildly in, labor that is normal. And that makes it really hard for doctors to understand, okay, this baby is experiencing some kind of problem and this one is totally fine. Many choose to err on the side of caution and say, okay, let's just go ahead, do the C-section in case there's a problem. And that leads to kind of the overuse of
And when
C-section
I
that I
think you just said 80% in the middle, that is a huge swath of labor and deliveries that fall in this place where the fetal monitoring system just doesn't seem to work. And so tell me about these outcomes and why doctors sort of lean into the C-section versus just, leaning back, waiting to gather more information. Why is that the decision?
Yes, we know from a very large review study that was done in 2017 that having electronic fetal monitoring raises the odds of C-section by about 63%. Pretty big increase. And the reason, we think that happened based on the reporting I've been doing is that doctors would prefer to act versus not act. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One big one that came up again and again in my reporting was the legal environment, that they worry about the possibility of, if there is a bad outcome, of the possibility of getting sued over that bad outcome. In some of these cases, they're becoming increasingly big verdicts. Just in your guys's neck of the wood, there was over a $200 million settlement against the University of Pennsylvania recently in a birth injury case. So they're worried about kind of the possible legal ramifications. And I had the same phrase repeated to me by a lot of doctors is nobody gets sued for doing the C-section. You only get sued for not doing the C-section. So if you do the C-section, baby's healthy, great. You did the surgery, the baby's healthy, and maybe you prevented something bad from happening. But I think that legal risk is often sitting in the back of the minds of doctors making these decisions.
You mentioned something that is so astounding, and I wanted to go back to it. The fact that the evidence around these monitoring devices has been thin for so long. And this is from your piece, a clinical trial that randomly assigned women to the device published in 1976 found no improvement in the number of newborn deaths or other negative outcomes. Since 1976. Look, we know research can move slowly and people, they're, doctors' associations are cautious about changing recommendations, but this feels like an outlier. How has the recommendation around, what is, first of all, what is the recommendation around electronic fetal monitoring or the official recommendation? And why has it not responded to this research?
Yeah, I found this really startling too, that all these studies that were done before I was born, showing that this monitor was not improving outcomes and was increasing C-section rates, that technology was still there when I had my kids a few years ago. It really shocked me as someone who's kind of been through this experience. The official guidance from ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, is that either that there are two types of monitoring that are appropriate. One is electronic monitoring, and the other is it's called intermittent auscultation, which is essentially those old-fashioned stethoscope checks. They say either is fine. That is different from the guidance in Britain and Canada, where they say for low-risk women, for healthy women, no adverse indications, that your first choice should be the stethoscope. That, if something bad happens, you can always upgrade to the electronic monitor, but your first choice is to be the stethoscope, so you don't get so many of those false positives. So I think that's one reason it sticks around, is that the guidance here in the United States says either is fine. And a lot of doctors I talked to said, when you kind of have a choice between the two, you often default to the monitor for a few reasons. One is it's more efficient, that you can have women on the monitor, you can check the monitor from your remote nursing station that's either in the hospital or outside the hospital. A lot of them like the idea of having a record that they could have other people look at and compare against. A lot of people aren't trained in the stethoscopes anymore. This has been going on so long that training and listening with stethoscopes is really falling out of obstetric residencies. So there's not kind of the skill set to do that kind of work. It also requires pretty high nursing ratios, having a 1-to-1 or 1-to-2 nursing ratio, and not all hospitals, have that in their labor delivery unit. So there's all these different forces that kind of push towards the monitor being the dominant way we check on
So
babies.
just to follow up on the efficiency front. So if it makes the whole process, because you do have to, you're supposed to monitor the fetal heart rate somehow. It's not that you shouldn't monitor, it's just that it's about the technique that you use, right? If the electronic technology allows for more efficiency, is that not an argument to keep doing it? Or does the data just suggest that that efficiency doesn't matter. It doesn't yield better outcomes. Because I would imagine if I'm trying to run a labor and delivery unit and you're telling me I have to spend more time doing task X, I'm going to be like, well, I don't want to. I want to put that labor, sorry, different type of labor, elsewhere. Help walk me through that, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tension here for through between what is best for patients and what is best for hospitals organizationally. So for the hospital, absolutely. I even went back and looked at some of the early advertisements for these devices. I went and looked through some medical journals from the 1960s where they really touted this is like having a nurse at every patient's bedside. One of these machines can monitor 8 people at once. And of course, if you're a hospital administrator, if you can have a machine that does the work of
Efficiency,
eight
yeah.
nurses, like why wouldn't you purchase it? But that often comes at the cost to patients who are having these unneeded C-sections that the monitor has repeatedly been shown to be associated with. I wrote a second story that published the same day as this one about the monitor, about a really serious complication of C-section called placenta accreta, very life-threatening, where the placenta in a future pregnancy gets stuck in the C-section scar and it has a quite high mortality rate. Those C-sections matter too. For most women, it's a safe surgery. Most women will not have that complication, but the patients do suffer when there is unneeded surgery, being done as part of childbirth.
Yeah, and can we talk about the C-section outcome? Because there's a ripple effect to this efficiency, right? And one of the things at the start of the show I talked about was the fact that there are a lot of decisions that are being made that have nothing to do with the actual care of the mother or the child. And so, can you talk about some of the side effects of C-section for people who may not know or may not remember that? Because you mentioned placenta accreta as a potential, outcome, but can you talk about why having an unnecessary C-section is a serious problem?
It's a major abdominal surgery, and anytime you can avoid doing a surgery you don't need to, generally the course of action is to avoid it. Again, it is a very safe surgery. Most patients who have a C-section will have a pretty quick recovery, no complications, but it introduces the risk of new complications that you wouldn't have had without a vaginal delivery. And, again, would also say vaginal delivery has its own complications, but if you look at the research, C-section comes, with higher rates of these complications. Placenta accreta is kind of the most serious one. I talked to multiple patients who had a C-section, that was pretty questionable on their first delivery, a few because of the electronic monitor. On their second delivery, they developed placenta accreta, had really challenging deliveries, lost liters and liters of blood. They all needed hysterectomies because their placentas and their uteruses just wouldn't detach from each other, which meant they could no longer have any more children, which was quite devastating to them. There is, the risk of, you have a new incision. There is the risk of infection. There are just all the risks that are associated with surgery. You're kind of bringing those on board. And then there's also just the patient's experience. A lot of patients, go into birth, wanting to have a certain experience, and that can get lost, with the decision to move to a C-section.
And in a lot of ways, the doctors, it seems like, see this as the lesser of two evils, right? They see the electronic fetal monitoring showing potentially the baby's in distress. And so to them, this is the lesser of two evils. So what are they really trying to prevent? Because one of the things that stood out to me was the expense of insurance for a lot of OBGYNs. So what are they really concerned about that they would rather do the C-section in order to avoid?
I think there's often concern that if something went wrong, that they could face litigation, and that rather than kind of keep a cautious eye on things, you're seeing some things on the monitor that might be concerning, might not, just making the decision a bit faster to say, let's end this labor, let's go to C-section. It gives, I talked to a lot of doctors who were quite critical of the device, who said, this is the worst test in medicine. One called it the shame of our specialty, useless, are terms I heard in my reporting. All these doctors still use the monitor, and they would admit it kind of gave them this sense of security, like they have some kind of insight into what's happening. I think
Like, it's
one of the
not just legal security. There is like a psychological
yeah, there's
security that comes
like a
with I
security
can look at
blanket.
a machine. It's not just me listening with the stethoscope, and I can say the machine is not like wrong, and it's there, and I can look at its data.
Exactly. And they all, they went to residency because this has been part of obstetrics for so long. They went to residency when the machine was always there, and the idea of kind of taking it away, it feels very alarming to them. And I've had a lot of doctors talk through who do this research that find that it doesn't work, who say, even so, I feel like it helps me. I feel like I'm a good user of the monitor and that it helps me practice better medicine. That is something, I've heard from doctors who were critical of my reporting in the past few days. Some who felt, look, the problem isn't the tool, the problem is how we use it, and the problem is some people overreacting. Right now, it seems like we have a lot of people overreacting, and despite 5 decades of research, we have not found a way to use this tool to deliver better outcomes
Without
without the side
overreaction.
effect of more C-sections.
We're asking you this hour, what's your experience with maternal care in this country? Are there changes that you'd like to see? It doesn't have to be about C-sections or electronic fetal monitoring, although if you have experience with those, very curious for your perspective. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Here's a comment from Casey. It's a little long, but it's interesting. Casey says, to make a long 6-night stay in the hospital story short, I was at a routine visit at 39 weeks pregnant and had elevated pressure. I was 37 at the time and thus considered at risk for preeclampsia. My OB recommended that I go to the hospital to be monitored during that time. My blood pressure came down. I figured they would let me go home, but because of my age, the attending physician recommended I stay in the hospital. To get to the C-section point, physicians tried so many ways to artificially progress my laboring, and nothing worked, only causing the fetal heart rate monitor to show multiple heart rate drops. And that made for an intense situation where I felt like I had to make the decision to voluntarily have a C-section to protect my baby's health. And that gets to a key point here, Sarah. You're talking about how the doctors interpret the data, but as you mentioned, the patients are exposed to this data on some level as well. And yes, they don't have the same level of expertise, but they are seeing the products of the monitor. And that can factor into the psychology of whether or not the patient agrees, right, to have a C-section. And you talked about someone actually in your reporting who recalled that experience. I'm curious how the patients experience the electronic fetal monitoring.
Yeah, I think you're referring to Sanquenese Henderson Pinckney, who was featured in my story, who had a C-section a few years ago with their son, and She described this. I think this is going to sound like a really familiar, experience to a lot of people listening who have had babies, that she would see the monitor drop. There was a very visual representation. Sometimes a bunch of doctors come rushing in. They're trying to reposition you, see if we can get the heart rate up. It feels emergent and scary. And she said, if when her doctor suggested a C-section, she readily agreed. She said, yeah, if you think he's in distress, like, let's get that baby out. Had an uneventful C-section, but then on her next pregnancy with her daughter in 2022, she developed placenta accreta, and had a pretty difficult delivery, had a hysterectomy, was pretty devastated to learn she could no longer have any more children. But I think that's something doctors also raised with me in my reporting, is that even if we say, okay, we're gonna, really double down on stethoscopes and we're gonna offer it to our patients and we're gonna be trained, would patients even want it? Or would they say, no, put it on the continuous monitor. I want to always be checking how my baby's doing. It's speaks to kind of a broader theme and, a lot of reporting I've done on medicine about overscreening, where we are constantly trying to get more information and it feels like more is better. But I think it's harder to see and understand there's also knock-on negative side effects to constantly checking something. There's room for more error and false positives.
Yeah, and on the line, we have a doctor that we want to hear from. We have Dr. Tanice Brandt. She's Medical Director of Labor and Delivery at Temple Women and Families Hospital. Dr. Tanice Brandt, you're on Studio 2. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And so you've been listening to our conversation with Sarah Cliff about her reporting. I just want to get your take on the use of this electronic fetal monitoring system. How do you use it when you're delivering a baby?
So great. So a lot of insight into the conversation. So I agree. When patients do present, we typically will place them on what we call the external fetal monitoring, which is an electronic system that assesses the baby's heart rate through the maternal abdomen. I think the big difference that I think sometimes does need a little bit clarification is that there is a difference between what we call intermittent fetal monitoring, which means you go in and monitor, say, every 20 minutes or so, or sometimes one time every hour, depending on if the patient is considered low risk. And that can be done in two ways. It can be done through auscultation with a fetal scope or a stethoscope. But the variability in that is sometimes a little bit harder to control. And so people can do what we call intermittent monitoring with the electronic fetal monitor. Or we can do continuous monitoring, which means you have the electronic fetal monitor that stays on the abdomen throughout the patient's care. And oftentimes it's that continuous monitoring that becomes the barometer that we watch, where we're talking about fetal heart patients being category one, category three, and then unfortunately the majority of them lining into category two.
That's an interesting insight. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Branch. Just so great to hear from someone in the field as we have this conversation. And that was an interesting nuance and distinction. We're about to go to break, Sarah. I'm just curious for your reaction to that
Yeah, I think
call.
that's a great point that you can also use the monitor in an intermittent way. I didn't run into a ton of hospitals doing that. Again, it's kind of like an ease of practice issue. If you're going to do it intermittently, you're constantly in there turning it on, turning it off, taking the straps on, taking them off. So it is a way you could use the monitor. It didn't seem to be an especially common one in my reporting, but a good point that you can also do this listening by just kind of turning the monitor off, for a large chunk of labor.
We're about to come up on a break, but we started to get into this conversation with screening, Sarah. And you're talking about how your reporting reflects some larger patterns in American healthcare. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about so the lawsuits and risk and some of the other patterns that you detected in your reporting on this topic that you think applies to other areas of medicine, because there's certainly a sort of a canary in the coal mine kind of element to this whole story. So we're talking with Sarah Cliff, investigative health reporter from the New York Times. We want to keep hearing from you, Studio 2 at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499. And don't go anywhere.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking with New York Times health policy reporter Sarah Cliff about the state of maternal health care and the high rates of C-section. She recently published an investigation called The Worst Test in Medicine about electronic fetal monitoring, a device that monitors the baby's heartbeat, and how this ubiquitous device is leading to unnecessary C-sections.
And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What's your experience with maternal care in this country? And are there changes that you'd like to see? Please share your story with us. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comments in the chat.
And we haven't actually talked about this. Maybe we should have before, Sarah. But how common is C-section in this country? What are the trend lines when it comes to the frequency of C-sections? And how does it compare to like international standards, what we see in other similar countries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so about 1 in 3 babies are delivered by C-section right now in the United States. And then if you focus in on a population that researchers often look at, generally I think of like healthy moms, first-time pregnancies, just one baby, no twins, full-term, babies facing down, that C-section rate's hovering about 26%. So about a quarter of these babies born to first-time moms who, you know, don't have any indication that should require a C-section end up delivering surgically. That number has ticked up slightly since the pandemic. And there, you know, might be some forces at play there. Hospitals might have been eager for good reasons during the pandemic to move people through the hospital faster, you know, to, you know, have less tolerance for long labors. There's not a ton of research showing, you know, why C-section rates have been going up since the pandemic. That's one idea that has been given to me by researchers, but small increases. Yeah. You know, we're talking about, you know, a few tenths of a percent each year. But when it's such a common procedure, it adds up to, you know, a significant number of more people getting C-sections. Our rates are somewhat comparable. You know, C-section rates are really all over a place across the world. In Brazil, for example, 60% of babies are delivered by C-section. And then, you know, in the UK and Canada, actually pretty similar rates, different drivers. And then if you look at some European countries, lower C-section rates, but there's a kind of really huge spectrum in different countries.
One of the things that stood out to me was some of the racial disparities in C-sections. You wrote that even if a Black mother and a white mother with similar medical histories saw the same doctor at the same hospital, the Black mother was about 20% more likely to have her baby via C-section. And you cite a study there. Can you explain these disparities and why there are more C-sections or Black mothers are more likely to have a C-section?
Yeah, this was a fascinating study of about 1 million births in New Jersey. It was actually the first study that got me interested in writing about C-sections more broadly. It was a study that came out at the end of 2024 that led to this whole larger reporting project I've been doing. And right, it found this really shocking disparity in how women are treated, where they really controlled for a lot of things, same hospital, same doctor, and still finding this disparity when you compared a Black woman and a white woman and their odds of getting C-section. One of the kind of most disturbing things about that study was they found the disparity was highest when there were more open operating rooms. You know, it does not seem like this is as simple as doctors saying, oh, there's an open operating room, I'm going to fill it immediately with my next Black patient, but it does suggest some kind of bias going on that is influenced by what resources are available at the hospital at that current time. You know, I think it speaks to a larger body of research on bias, whether conscious or unconscious, in the medical system. You know, for various reporting I've done on maternal health, I've interviewed a number of Black women who felt, you know, they weren't really heard in labor, their concerns were dismissed, and that affected the type of care that they got. So it is a quite large study, very statistically significant, that suggested some disparities in how women of different races are treated when they give birth.
And quick follow-up to that, because one of the things that also stood out to me was that the fact that there is this disparity and that the doctors and clinicians know that a racial disparity exists, that might be a motivating factor for suggesting a C-section. Could you explain that and how you sort of pulled this out or parsed this out?
Yeah, it's a really tricky area because, again, I don't think doctors are consciously saying, this is my next black patient. I'm going to do a C-section. I think it's much more nuanced than that. Some of the doctors I talked to said they kind of were thinking about that bias and monitoring more and looking more. And then if you're looking closer at the monitor, you might find something you don't like and lead to C-section. So it's a really tricky topic, but one with quite serious consequences. We know that black women have a higher rate of maternal mortality than white women in the United States. And a lot of the patients I talked to, with placenta accreta, this complication I looked into, were black patients who felt that, their concerns that the doctors had a, real I know best attitude when it came to their delivery and suggesting C-section. They can't speak to what it would have been like to deliver with another race, but they can speak to their own experience, which suggested that, their concerns were kind of written off in favor of what the doctor thought was best.
Interesting pair of comments here from YouTube, and interesting in the sense that they're opposing, but also that they both reference experiences that happened like 50 years ago, and we were talking about how this technology has been around for so long. Mara on YouTube says, I had a complicated pregnancy in 1977, so my doctor asked if I would allow this new monitor while my daughter was breaching and the cord was wrapped around her neck. The monitor saved her life. Trish on YouTube says, I was a certified nurse midwife in several hospitals, and I'm old enough to remember the data from the 1970s that did not support routine continuous use of electronic fetal monitoring. First of all, any reactions to those comments, Sarah? And also just like, well, I'll ask my second question after I get your reaction.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't necessarily frame those as opposing because I
Yeah.
think many doctors agree in like a situation like the first commenter was describing. The baby is breached, you suspect something might be going wrong. Many doctors, agree, yes, the monitor makes sense in that situation. When generally, when you're doing a screening test, which is one way to think about monitoring, generally screening tests are more appropriate when, there's a higher incidence of problem. You're going to have fewer false positives, fewer true problems. And so I think, that sounds like it was possibly, an appropriate
Yeah.
use of the monitor, in that case.
Yeah, that's a good point. So one thing I just want to kind of, I don't know, bring into focus here is that we're talking about the unnecessary use of C-sections, and we're talking about the fact that America has a relatively high maternal mortality rate. That said, like, I guess we should establish that C-sections as an intervention have helped, I would imagine, a lot of people. We're talking about the overuse, but we shouldn't confuse that with C-section
Proper
equals
use, yes.
bad. And I just wanted to let you maybe lay that out for our listeners, because I sometimes do think it can get lost in a conversation like this.
Yeah, no, I do think that's exactly right, that there is a lot of appropriate use of C-section in our country, cases where it is clearly an indicated intervention that is helpful to the mom and the baby. I think one of the things that's incredibly tricky in this space is figuring out when to use it and how much to use it. There's a worry, I've talked to some hospitals who, set a clear target, others who really worry about setting a clear target because they don't want to incentivize, avoiding C-section when it is necessary. So it is a really complex area. The more I thought about it, writing about this topic for the past year, it's just so different than so many other parts of things that are happening in a hospital where you have two really different ways to kind of accomplish the same goal. You have, a patient who's pretty involved in the mix in the way they wouldn't be for a knee replacement or a hip replacement or so many other things that are happening in a hospital. It's just a really complex part, that doesn't neatly slot into the way hospitals often function. And I think that just makes it a really tricky issue to get our arms around.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments. We have Judy on YouTube who says a mother is in a very vulnerable position. Literally and figuratively, you have to advocate for yourself, but also for your baby from that position, and it is really hard. Heather from Wallingford says, 20 years ago, I was in labor with my daughter. I was induced, so I had an epidural. I could still feel contractions happening, but they weren't registering on the monitor. I mentioned it to the resident, but she said that my contractions would be showing up. And she left the room. I reached down and could feel the baby's head. So my husband ran out to tell my doctor. And then the whole team ran in. My doctor said, I always tell my residents to listen to the mom. This was a good lesson for that resident. And so I just wonder, like, you know, the reliance in this from Heather's story was so much on the monitor that mm-hmm. the doctor, the resident, the young doctor didn't even listen to the mother telling her what right. she knew to be true. So, yeah. you know, I wonder, like, if we think about solutions and we think about, you know, this over-reliance on technology here, mm-hmm. how do you sort of wean yourself off? Because there's this movement going now when we talk about maternal mortality mm-hmm. that women want to go back to, you know, the more natural way of giving birth. They want to have, you know, midwives and they want to have doulas and all these things. Right. So how do you sort of make a shift in a responsible way, knowing yeah. that there are good reasons for C-sections, good reasons for technological, mm-hmm. you know, technology being a part of the birthing process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tricky. You know, one, I think, is actually the idea offered by the doctor from Temple earlier is, you know, asking about, am I a good candidate for, you know, intermittent electronic monitoring that doesn't require people to know how to use the stethoscopes? And I think it is, you know, like your other viewer was suggesting, it is tricky because as a patient, you kind of feel like you're not in the position of power. You want to be on good terms with this doctor who's going to be helping you deliver a
yes,
baby.
Yes.
But you also want to advocate. You don't want to be the annoying patient, but you also want to advocate for yourself. And I think that might be, you know, one that the patients might think about, you know, asking, you know, am I a good candidate for this? Who might you use this with? You know, maybe even having those conversations a little earlier in pregnancy at your prenatal visits to get a sense of, you know, is intermittent monitoring something your hospital would be comfortable with? One thing I think that makes it so tricky is it's really difficult to figure out if your hospital is one that relies on C-section a lot or not. Those, you know, hospital specific or doctor specific C-section rates are really, really tricky, sometimes impossible to get. There's no requirement for hospitals to report them publicly, which can make it hard to kind of wrap your arms around, am I in a hospital that, you know, does a lot of C-sections or am I one with a pretty low rate? Mm. But I think, you know, maybe having that idea about intermittent monitoring as a possible option in the back of your head is one kind of concrete thing someone, you know, having a baby could be thinking about.
Interesting chart from your investigation, Sarah, showing that, you know, fetal distress account is like the not the main, but the plurality of C-sections for low risk births are mm-hmm. because of fetal distress. We have the graphic now up on the screen. Number two is labor not progressing. And I'm wondering if there are also issues there, like perhaps providers are too hasty to go to C-section mm-hmm. if a labor is progressing slowly. Then that's nothing to do with this technology necessarily, but I'm just curious if there's other areas where we see over-reliance on C-section in addition to fetal distress mm-hmm. and monitoring.
Yeah, the labor not progressing is an interesting one. And you've actually seen a pretty steep decline in that one over the last, you know, 10 or so years, which a lot of doctors actually attribute to a change in professional guidelines. Mm. ACOG put out new guidelines that essentially said, you know, gave longer for labor, said you should give each stage longer. And that seemed to come out of a concern that doctors were going to see, were calling a labor failed, not progressing too quickly. So I think that chart to me also shows the power of these professional societies. When they said, okay, you need to give more time, all of a sudden we saw a big decline in labor's not progressing. It turns out, you know, just some women weren't getting enough time to labor. Yeah. So yeah, that's another interesting, we didn't have space to write about that in the story, but that's another interesting thing going on in that chart.
Yeah, Hillary from Cape May says, I had my first baby in the hospital and my second baby at home. I had intermittent fetal monitoring in the first birth and only midwife listening, no monitor for second birth, both vaginal births. She says, I have to say the home birth experience was wonderful, less psychological fears, more empowering and feeling more in control of my own birth and quicker recovery time. The environment, not hearing beeps, no bright lights, ability to make your own decisions, etc., makes a big difference in terms of progressing a healthy birth. If you were to, we started talking about solutions from a patient point of view, like the things you as a patient could ask for. If you were to run a hospital tomorrow, given what you discovered in your reporting, I know you're not a doctor, but if you were to suggest some changes, you know, because this study, people have known this information for decades mm-hmm. at this point, and it doesn't seem like it's gonna change anything.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the feedback I heard about what could change things, I think sits even higher than a hospital administrator. Part of it, you know, which we've touched on a little bit, is the legal environment, is this yeah. fear of litigation and that, despite the relationship between oxygen deprivation during one of the things that the monitor, doctors hope the monitor would pick up is signs of oxygen deprivation during labor and delivery, which could lead to a traumatic brain injury, which often is expressed as cerebral palsy. And the relationship has the is quite weak, essentially. And so I think one, you would need some kind of reform in how medical malpractice work so that that is not as much of an issue in the back of the minds of doctors as they're thinking about this. The other are professional guidelines. Right now, our professional guidelines in the US differ from those in places like Britain or Canada, which state quite clearly that for low risk patients, intermittent checking is the right move, whereas our guidelines say continuous, intermittent, it's kind of up to you, either is fine. So, those are kind of two larger forces. And I think that chart kind of showing the big decline in stalled labors really does speak to the impact that guidelines from professional organizations can have on the care that gets delivered to patients.
Well, I just loved all your insights this hour, and thank you for your investigative work and for bringing this, raising the profile of this issue, which I know has been out there for a while as we've been talking about, but without reporting like this, it's hard to get the focus on it. So thank you, Sarah Cliff, investigative healthcare reporter for the New York Times. Appreciate your insights this hour on Studio 2.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you to everybody who wrote in and shared your stories. We really appreciate you. And have to say thank you to our producers. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes, and now also by Hazel May Bryan, our brand new producer. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show,
three
Hazel.
Welcomes.
We are thrilled to have you on the Studio 2 team. Also want to say thank you to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique, engineer of today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk to you tomorrow.